This episode is brought to you by Southern Farm and Garden, a beautiful handcrafted agricultural journal. Subscribe today at southernfarmandgarden.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Greetings and welcome to Animal Instinct here on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Celia Kutcher. I'm also known as the Food Healer, and welcome to the show. Today, we've got a pretty heavy topic online. I am going to be speaking with David Niter all about trophy hunting. We're going to be talking specifically about around South Africa. And so I just want to get started because this is quite a conversation. So I'm just going to jump in. So Dave, are you there?
Yes, I'm right here. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you so much for talking about this with me. It's such a topic of the moment, and I'm really, really excited to share this information with the listeners. So if it's okay with you, can we just jump in both feet and
Get
all wet? Mm-hmm. Awesome. Thanks. All right. So we're talking about trophy hunting today, specifically African animals like lions and elephants. What prompted you to start researching this?
Well, I think that, my interest in trophy hunting, I guess, stems from, some of the traveling I've done in the past and, development of love for animals and some of my prior research. And it's a culmination of those things that actually kind of ended up, with me looking at trophy hunting. I lived for quite some time in South Africa, actually, working as a Peace Corps volunteer. And I met a lot of people that were involved in the industry. I went on a lot of safaris. Mm-hmm. So I saw a lot of lions. I saw a lot of elephants. I went to Kruger National Park, and I actually recall having a conversation with one of the park's rangers, actually on a bushwalk, about the elephants that were in the park. And he mentioned that sometimes elephants get cold. And that sparked a real interest. Why are elephants being cold?
Yeah.
That's because of the management that's necessary for parks, right? Parks just don't occur naturally there. Mm-hmm. They're a part of humans create these parks, and so they need to be managed. And so over time, there are too many elephants in the park, and so sometimes these elephants are killed.
Mm.
And so that sparked a little bit of an interest in me. And then I met people that owned land, and I also met hunters that would talk about the beauty of various species like kudu or gemsbok, mm-hmm. or nyala, and talk about these creatures in this really reverent way. And then they would show me a picture of them dead.
Ugh.
And I said, okay, there's something really interesting here, right? And then I did my master's research in geography, mm-hmm. looking at the politics of conservation and the way that spaces are made. And it's really interesting to see that how nature reserves are actually made and how they're this sort of ongoing process of colonialism. And so I was looking at the connection between colonialism and conservation.
Mm-hmm.
And because conservation is a very colonial thing, it started, late 19th century, it moved forward and it's expanded into the proliferation of a lot of protected areas.
Yeah.
And so I was thinking about colonialism, and then Cedric the Lion.
Ugh.
And then that cemented all of my feelings and my urges that I've had about animals and about animal justice, and animal mm-hmm. welfare, animal rights. It struck a nerve with me. And then so what I did was I decided to do some more research, because I'd done a little bit of research when I was looking at South Africa and the creation of nature reserves.
Mm-hmm.
I learned a little bit about the environment and the history of the environment in South Africa, and learned about hunting and the role that it actually played into the creation of game reserves and parks. And then, I said, you know what? I need to learn more about this. And so right on the heels of the Cedric the Lion slaughter, essentially,
mm-hmm.
I heard or caught wind that there was a large hunting convention taking place in Las Vegas.
Oh, wow.
It's actually the largest international hunting convention. It's called Safari Club International Hunters Convention. And it's a place where thousands of people converge in one space in Las Vegas, right?
Wow.
Which is, you know, really, really interesting, I think, you know.
Yeah, totally.
Anyway, so I meet all of these different people, safari outfitters, landowners, hunters, and I begin to see the way that hunting is made, the way that hunting is conserved. It's not that hunting is leads to greater amounts of conservation. It's the idea that hunters are doing everything they can to conserve their right to continue to hunt. And so these were some feelings and some things that I got while I kind of looked around and I, you know, observed and I met with people, maybe sometimes a little bit unethically, not divulging essentially who I was.
Mm-hmm.
But I would go up to people and I'd say, "Hey, I'd like to hunt an elephant. How do I do that?"
Mm-hmm.
And then the person would be able to come on in. And generally, the way these giant convention halls are set up is that you have tents everywhere, all in the colonial manner, looking like something out of a Theodore Roosevelt trip to Africa, right?
Okay.
So you see all these different skins everywhere and pictures of like African landscapes without people. Of course, the NRA is there, but that's a whole other thing.
Yeah, totally.
And then so I start talking to this man, to this hunter, and I ask him about the elephant and the life of the elephant, and he says it's just a beautiful thing. He said that when he killed the elephant, he cried. And so I pressed further. I'm like, "Why did you cry? It's just the most beautiful thing. It was this dream of mine to go to Africa and hunt an elephant."
Oh, my God.
And so you see this creation, this discourse kind of playing around and recreating this colonial hunter,
mm-hmm.
right? What it means to be a hunter and to go out into the bush and be a man.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, So I wanted to know a little bit more about it. So I asked him about what happens to the elephant when it's killed, and he said the ivory tusks would go home with him, and they would be on his fireplace, on either side of his fireplace.
Oh, Jesus.
And then I pressed further, and he disclosed that he was going to use the disembodied feet of the elephant as waste baskets. So for me, I was kind of shocked and taken aback, but that's something that a legacy, again, of the colonial era. So it was really, really interesting experience. And I can continue to talk about this one particular place because it's so important, I think, as people who are trying to understand what's going through the mind of trophy hunters is like. What is it like? And how is trophy hunting made?
Yeah.
And you go to these spaces and you see, right, all the artwork. You see all the guns.
Mm.
I counted there were 72 places within the convention to get guns,
oh my God.
To buy bullets, and so on. And then there were so it creates this whole sort of commodity chain that's created.
Mm-hmm.
And proliferates on account of the trophy hunting industry. So, yeah, really, really interesting stuff.
It's fascinating. I mean, it's interesting, too, because I know some people that trophy hunt, or that used to trophy hunt, I should say. If they're still doing it, they're not admitting it to me. And their whole thing, like, anytime you ask them, it's like, "Oh, my God, because the animals are so beautiful and majestic." And it's like, okay, so this
right.
animal is beautiful and majestic, so you're going to murder it. You know, it's like, in my brain, I mean, I'm sorry, but in my brain, I don't get this. You know, it doesn't make any sense to me of like, "Oh my God, I saw the most beautiful thing I ever saw in my life and I killed it and it's on my wall now." And it's like, "Oh my God, like, what are you doing?" You know? So, one of the questions I wanted to ask you, because this is something I didn't know, when people are doing this kind of hunting for this wild game, I mean, are they in the wild hunting this? Are they just like, you know, everywhere, or are they limited to certain places?
Oh, that's a really good question. So a lot of the hunting actually takes place on private property, private game reserves, actually. So, and many of these, and a majority of these spaces which allow hunting, where they're called hunting concessions, where hunting concessions actually occur, mm-hmm. are actually products of land that had been taken during the colonial or during the apartheid era.
Oh, wow.
So all of these spaces that are privately owned are owned by white South Africans. And so in South Africa, you know, over 80% of the population is black South Africans. Only about 10% are white.
Mm-hmm.
But you still have a majority of the land that's still owned by white South Africans.
Mm-hmm.
So they've been able to take this idea of conservation and run with it. Prior to these spaces being utilized for hunting, they were first actually used for agricultural production.
Hmm.
But then, like, there was drought, and then there was subsidies that were removed. A number of things had actually taken place to encourage people to transform their farms that was used for, like, you know, large scale, like not wildlife, cows,
uh-huh.
and sheep, and different things like that kind of production, to move it towards the wildlife industry. And so now in South Africa, you have approximately 10,000 places where there's either breeding of animals,
hunting
of animals, or the combination of the two. Yeah, there are about 10,000 of them.
Holy cow.
And so they're all over the country. So what the interesting thing about it, too, is that these private reserves make up approximately 80% of the protected area in South Africa.
Wow.
So the idea is that so what's happened essentially is that the state has passed off essentially its responsibility for conservation of biodiversity, has passed it on to the private sector,
wow.
which has allowed for the hunting to continue. Right. So if this land was
yeah.
publicly owned, it's, you know, it's very rare that there's hunting that's allowed upon that land.
Okay.
So this is where a lot of the hunting has actually taken place, and the people that are hunting, they make a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
They're primarily, you know, they're upper middle class, or if not more affluent
mm-hmm.
as well. And these spaces, again, they serve to exclude populations of people. So the fact that there are hunting concessions means that it requires less amount of labor, less amount of work. So they
mm-hmm.
don't have to rely upon black South Africans to help. So it's increasingly becoming this really homogenous, sort of whitened space that's happening in South Africa today on account of this conservation trophy hunting idea, which is very, very ethically dubious, of
course. Seriously.
Yeah.
I mean, this is...
Yeah.
You know, it's really interesting because it's like, you know, you see, like, for example, there was a, you know, a piece on the news about 2 weeks ago of, you know, someone who shall be nameless holding up the tail of a dead elephant, which sparked all this.
About.
I know. I can't even go there. You know what I mean? But, you know, it really
yeah.
sparked a lot of conversation, as did Cecil, you know, and so people start
right.
asking lots of questions about this, and it's... I had no idea until I was first speaking to you about what an industry this is. And so I think that that's a part of this that's so, so important to keep in mind because, you know, a lot of people will be like, you know, well, why is this happening? And it's like, because a lot of people are making money.
Yes, that's exactly it. There's so much money that's being made right now. I mean, we're talking, millions, if not billions, well, billions of rand, especially. You're talking,
Jesus.
You know, $3 billion or more dollars that are being made through live sales of, you know, of wildlife at wildlife ranches.
Oh, my God.
You know, millions of dollars being made just off the trophy hunting industry itself, which, of course, equates to animals, right? The
yeah.
number of animals that are actually being killed, right? So
yeah.
in 2013, in South Africa, there were over 7,000 hunts.
Holy cow.
Equaling 44,000 trophies. So
whoa.
Something we really have to be thinking about, right, is that there's animals are being lost in this mix.
Yeah.
You know, there are lions that are also being killed and elephants that are also being killed. Elephants from... I have data, but not from the last few years, but for about averaging about 1,000 elephants being killed a year.
Oh, my God.
Approximately the same for lions. But the thing with lions, interestingly, is that many of those lions, at least half of them, most of them are hunted by American hunters.
Mm-hmm.
Most of these lions are actually being canned.
Mm.
So they're a product of canned hunting. So they're being specifically bred in these very, very tight and sketchy enclosures And they're being essentially bred to be then bought at auction or bought by a professional hunter or so on, to then be killed and shot by a client from overseas. And so who is going to spend a lot of money for that?
Yeah.
You know, $30,000, $50,000 they're going to spend just to kill this lion. And the idea is that, so there are about 200 of these particular kinds of enclosures.
My God.
Equaling about 8,000 lions that are not wild, but they're not domestic, right?
Yeah.
Kind of blurring the lines between what is what here. And so a lot, they're just being essentially bred to be killed. So what's also happened, which is really interesting, is that it's opened up this sort of volunteer industry.
Mm-hmm.
So some of these farms where they're breeding these lions are creating the false idea that people can come and like pet and help take care of the lions.
Oh God!
So they're coming and they're seeing the these little cubs, and they're petting the cub.
Mm-hmm.
They're going out and walks with the lions as well as they're getting older.
Oh,
and then to the point where they're grown up and they have a nice mane, they're beautiful, and then they're sold. And when they're sold, it's the canned hunt, right? They're sold into another enclosure, essentially,
mm-hmm.
where they can't escape. They have no fear of human beings either because they've been essentially hand-raised.
Yeah, totally.
They're all by themselves. They're unfamiliar with the territory. They don't have a pride. They didn't grow up there. They don't know the other lions that are there, if there are any other lions that are there to begin with.
Yeah.
They don't know where to find their food. They're not wild. They've been... And so suddenly, then they're shot and they're killed.
Oh, Jesus.
By affluent hunters. And the thing is, affluent hunters these days, they don't want to spend a lot of money if they're not guaranteed the kill. And so they go with the expectation that they are going to be successful.
And this is
how the hunting industry, you know, advertises and markets itself, right?
Yeah.
They're trying to market themselves against others for the guaranteed kill. Because if somebody's going to fly from the United States to Africa, they want to know that it's going to happen.
Oh, my God. It's like a video game, you know?
Yeah, it's really unfortunate. It's just the sort of the commodification of wildlife as
yeah.
we know it today.
Yeah, totally.
Right. And so, right.
God,
so they're placing a monetary value, applying this profit principle to species, and that's another thing is the idea that, you know, if it pays, it stays. The animal stays on the land
mm-hmm.
so long as it, you know, can pay off
mm-hmm.
in the end. If it has no value monetarily, then it's worth nothing and it's not worth saving.
God.
So this is the ethic that's being followed today, unfortunately. And so yeah, we see a lot of lions that are being killed, and they're mostly it's Americans. Americans probably import the most trophies of any country.
Are you, oh God!
In the world. Yes.
USA, USA. Right. God, this is terrible.
It's like, interesting.
I just want to burst into tears here.
Yeah, so I'm a part of. So I became a member of Safari Club International,
mm-hmm.
just so I can get. You can't go to these events unless you become a member. So
mm-hmm.
I had to pay my fees and everything, and now I get, you know, mail from them and magazines from
God.
Them. So I get all of this data essentially that I can use for research purposes. And I got one piece of mail, and it asked me, and this is really interesting. It was a 2016 proxy ballot
mm-hmm.
From Safari Club International Political Action Committee. So it's their super PAC, right? That works on, you know, works in D.C. lobbying, right?
Yeah.
The continued killing of animals.
And
on this proxy ballot, it asks, do you believe that our American heritage of hunting and our rights to travel overseas to hunt
oh my God.
and import game species are worth fighting for? So there's a lot to unpack
wow.
in this pack, I guess, this political action committee and what they're saying here, right? So the idea that there's, you know, hunting is a heritage that's distinctly
yeah.
American, which is false. And I would also contend that trophy hunting is not heritage,
mm-mm.
right? Trophy hunting is the elite.
Very much so,
It's class-based. The heritage itself is subsistence. Right.
Totally.
So the idea is false to begin with. And then they believe they have a right to go other places in the world and kill things and then import them. So again, it's this very colonial sort of mentality that they get to go places and take what they think is rightfully theirs because it exists elsewhere.
Yeah.
This is a very dangerous sort of mentality.
Seriously.
That's being perpetuated within this industry. And it informs the way that people think.
Yeah.
And, of course, it creates these larger distinctions amongst those people and then the others, you know, the greenies, who are us, right? The greenies.
Exactly. We're the bad ones.
Yeah, right.
We're the riffraff and the troublemakers, you know, which I love. But actually, I need to take a quick break. I don't want to, but I have to. I am speaking to Dave Nider right now all about trophy hunting in South Africa. We'll be back in a minute, minute and a half to continue this conversation. So just stay tuned.
This episode is brought to you by Southern Farm and Garden, a beautiful, handcrafted agricultural journal. Each issue features stories about food history, seasonal recipes, artisanal products, and the amazing people who bring it to your table. Packed with stunning photography, the content is fresh and educational. Southern Farm and Garden takes you behind the scenes to meet farmers, gardeners, wineries, chefs, and artists who are passionate about creating healthy, unique, and sustainable food and products that you can enjoy all year. Are you interested in eating healthier and learning more about where your food comes from and living a more connected life? Subscribe today to southernfarmandgarden.com. Foodtank.com names Southern Farm and Garden one of the top 20 magazines for people who eat, cook, and grow, praising it for connecting readers with the food, the farms, and the stories behind our food system. Subscribe today or find a retailer near you at southernfarmandgarden.com.
And we are back. I am talking to Dave Nider all about trophy hunting in South Africa. I'm fascinated by this subject. I didn't think it was going to be as complicated as it is. Dave, question for you. With all these kinds of animals being endangered, how is this hunting happening? Like, is this really legal?
Yeah, it actually is legal, right? The trade and the selling for commercial purposes is not legal. So you have tusks or rhino horns or lion bones, which is something that's becoming more popular now. These things aren't legal, but yes, according to the Convention on trading endangered and threatened species, you can. Even these species that are Appendix 1 species, which, you know, outlaws and or prohibits any sale for commercial purposes, but you can still, there's a loophole with trophy hunting. And that if the hunt in some particular way is contributing, the money is contributing, or to, or the hunt is contributing to science in a particular way, or the furthering of conservation efforts, then yes, it can continue to be done. However, there's a quota on it, and each country has a different quota, obviously, for it. But yes, it can continue. And all of it also depends on the country as well. Like certain countries will just outlaw it altogether, place moratoriums on it. So actually recently, there's a moratorium now on leopards. It's going on to its second year now.
Oh, thank God.
And the interesting thing about the moratorium is that the Department of Environmental Affairs in South Africa had done a study and concluded that the dwindling number of leopards found in South Africa is due to trophy hunting.
Oh,
so they attributed the loss, the unsustainability of this species due to trophy hunting, while trophy hunters are stating emphatically that it's the opposite. So it's very interesting to see how this thing plays out. Again, it's in its second year now. And then we're also seeing this pushback, despite the fact that it is legal, but there's pushback, you know, with airlines. We're not going to import, lions or any parts of lions. You know, New Jersey now is saying we're not going to import anything from the Big Five, right?
Wow.
The Big Five in South Africa are like, you know, elephants, lions, leopards, rhinos. So they're not going to an African buffalo.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to, you know, import any of those things. So there's some encouragement here, I guess. But you know, there we would is, like to see that none of this continues.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, hats off for Newark Airport and for New Jersey, but the fact of the matter is if somebody who's wealthy lives in this area, they can go to JFK, they can go to LaGuardia, they can, you know, fly their right. private jet to Westchester. And so, I mean, I'm all for what Newark's doing. I think it's great, you know, but the problem is that a lot of these hunters have enough money that they can, you know, get through the loophole on that or fly somewhere else or, you know, bribe somebody at the gate or, you know, whatever the case may be. I mean, my question, which I've asked hunters this, and, you know, I'm always like, how, okay, you see this thing, you think it's the most beautiful thing you've ever seen and so majestic and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. So your goal is to hunt this thing down and kill it. And their response is always, well, we have to hunt them for the species to survive. Can you explain right. that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. So the idea is that the money that's being, so they're going, you know, they're flying, you know, spending lots of money to go to, you know, to Africa, mm-hmm. Go to, you know, Zambia or South Africa, and they're going to pay $30,000, $50,000 to kill this animal. So the idea is that some of the money that's from that actually goes towards the conservation of protected areas, that it contributes to the protection of, you know, biological conservation. Hmm. Now, it's a bit murky,
okay.
actually. I think that there's they make these claims, but there's not a lot of evidence to support these particular claims.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea is that the only way to do it is by killing animals, but it's false, right? It's a false dichotomy.
Yeah,
it's false representation, because actually, conservation can work without killing animals, right? Like we could further subsidize ecotourism pursuits. We can further subsidize, you know, national parks or the formation of national parks, mm-hmm. right? We can support, you know, landowners. We can ask if we can, you know, for them to care for them as easements.
Yeah.
Like, there's a number of different avenues. They're all imperfect, obviously, but there are different ways to kind of skirt around actually killing something to save it. And so that's a very, very disingenuous argument that they make, especially in light of the fact that, you know, they're breeding animals to such, I mean, it's so quickly now.
Yeah.
That they can't kill them fast enough.
Oh, God.
You know, so, and, you know, the industry is oh, my goodness. There's an investment group called COA Investments,
mm-hmm.
and they're online, and they believe, what is it? They believe in breeding animals, right? Mm-hmm. And they get investments from people that have all sorts of money. So they have auction prices. They're the top, you know, five rare species, and they say that they've achieved a growth of 49% per annum over 5 years, from 2010 to 2015.
Oh, God.
The buffalo grew, sort of appreciated in value by mm-hmm. over 540%.
Wow.
So there's these market values, essentially, that are leading to greater amounts of investment.
Okay.
And they're stating that, like, this investment is greater, it will outperform, and is more predictable and stable than the stock market itself.
Wow.
So there's this real push. And some of these investment companies, too, interestingly enough, also, you know, that buy up the space to breed the animals, they're uh-huh. also utilizing some of their money and helping to fund non-governmental organizations.
Mm.
So now we're seeing this merger between the hunting industry,
mm-hmm.
right, and conservation, right? So they're reconciling. There's a reconciliation,
wow.
I guess, if you will, that's occurring.
Yeah.
There's a chimpanzee park in South Africa. Some of the, it's partially funded or sponsored actually by COA Investments.
Mm-hmm.
So you're seeing some of this connection. You're seeing also very, very rich, like, philanthropists that are funding, you know, large-scale conservation.
Mm-hmm.
But then they're using it to actually profit off of it themselves.
Oh, God.
So it's dark.
Yeah, it is.
You actually,
I mean,
really go down into the rabbit hole, if you will. But yeah, again, but the idea that you have to kill to save the species, again, is disingenuous.
Yeah, but especially for something that's this endangered. You know what I mean? Because it's like, what breaks my heart is the fact that you've got people breeding these animals to be hunted, and the fact that that's worth more to them and is more valuable to them than actually rehabbing these animals so they can, like, restock the wild ones. Like, that breaks my heart, because you would think that, you know, and it's like, why would they? I mean, if they're making $50,000 off of one, the death of one lion, why are they going to rehab something and, you know, have a born-free moment with Elsa? Because that it's not going to be worth a penny to them. It's just going to be some random lion, you know, like that. The
right.
It has nothing to, obviously, it has nothing to do with the well-being of the animal, I mean, needless to say, you know? And that's the part that kills me.
It has nothing to do with the animal itself. It has nothing to do with real biodiversity or the protection of ecosystems. It has nothing to do with any of that. You can't claim that it is when you're actually utilizing it in that particular way.
Yeah.
When you're just using it just to kill it and, you know, and then put it up on your wall. So there's a really large distinction between, like, those subsistence hunters. I think you can make those hunters can sort of make an argument, right, that they're gaining a deeper, like, understanding and appreciation of that animal, the external natural resources and their dependency upon them.
Mm-hmm.
And so it leads to greater amounts of respect and for conservation's sake, but not for the conservation of keeping animals alive long enough to actually kill them.
Yeah.
So they're completely two different sort of ideas.
And
the thing is, too, a lot of these hunters will claim that, you know, they're trying to escape, you know, capitalist industrialist society and just go back to the frontier and regain this, you know, sense of self-reliance. But I would say that's a contradiction in and of
itself. Seriously?
These hunters are so completely dependent upon all the gadgetry and all the catchings of capital. So
no, that's such bullshit. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, but it really is. It, like, that's, I mean, okay, so, like, oh no, I want to get back to my roots. So all of a sudden you've got someone in 2017 who thinks they're, you know, freaking African explorers that go to the expensive uniform places to get their whole, like, pith helmet and, you know, have their Livingston moment that, like, that didn't even apply, to their heritage and all this, to kind of be, like, fancy and, you know, one of those people, kind of like a VIP thing. Like, this is such a class thing as well.
Oh, yeah, it's absolutely class thing. And it's interesting to actually watch it unfold when you go to these particular conventions and you hear the way that people talk about going to Africa.
Yeah.
You know, there's this aura that's around it. And, you know, very, very famous hunter there is Craig Boddington. And mm-hmm. he's talking about, you know, how hunting in Africa is something you never get out of your system.
It's
a drug, essentially, that you have to just keep going. So he's continuing to build up that myth,
yeah,
of going of Africa. And of course, like, no one there has any geographic, political, social, historical understanding of these places that they're actually going to.
Yeah, exactly.
They don't know that these spaces are products of colonialism or they're the continuation of colonialism. I mean, they're being fed all sorts of information that's mm-hmm. completely erroneous. I mean, I went to one session where they were talking about this anti-poaching unit working together with former special ops, like Americans,
uh-huh.
special ops, and uniting these things with hunting in this place called Kutata 16 in Zambia.
Oh, God.
And they were talking about the poaching that's taken place and how they have to rehabilitate the poachers
mm-hmm.
and teach them how to, like, respect and be responsible for the wildlife, but they never talked essentially about the fact that these people were actually subsistence hunters that
yeah.
were pushed off their land for
yeah.
the making of a national park.
Oh, God. Oh, God.
And this is very recent, actually. This is a recent creation of actually a transfrontier park, Greater Limpopo Transfrontier Park.
Mm-hmm.
The bringing together you know, parks from Zimbabwe, Mozambique, and Kruger National Park in Zimbabwe. So they displaced people and then they turned them into poachers.
Lovely.
Right.
And this,
they're saying, well, we're, yeah.
Yeah, this makes me nuts because I have a dear friend who has a rhino rescue in Africa, and it's like, It's all about the poachers, you know, which I understand this. And, you know, poachers are not good. Mm-hmm. Like, this is bad. But right. I would assume that the poachers aren't killing nearly as many as the tourists that are coming down there.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Like the local population aren't the ones that are decimating elephants and rhinos necessarily, right? I mean, there are crime syndicates, though, of course. I mean, you have to be aware of that. And there, the number of rhinos has gone up. Increasingly over the last 10 years, alarmingly so. So I do think that has to be, you know, ameliorated as well. But just to sit here and criminalize people for poaching, I think is a little bit, you know, short-sighted. I think a little bit of a simplification.
And so, like, what makes these hunters different from poachers, really?
That's a great question.
I mean, it's kind of like,
I mean, this is something that was created over time as well, right? The idea that, you know, the white hunter comes in with a greater set of values and understandings about the value of nature and wildlife, and knows how to kill things, and isn't so savage-like. So in many ways, it's sort of a carryover. I think. And then, you know, they say that poachers, you know, resort to very, like, savage, barbarous ways of killing animals, like using, like, snares and different things like that. Although, if we look at this historically, we'll see that poachers are using some of this equipment because they weren't able to actually access guns, or it was illegal for them to even have guns.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen that here in the United States as well, in the formation of parks too, right? So the idea that blacks shouldn't have guns.
This is so racist.
That white people would feel safe. But then they're accused of actually, you know, hunting in such a way that's just absolutely barbarous.
Yeah,
which,
exactly.
Again, it's a bit misinformed. As well.
No,
and there's a lot
is...
of people that are like that are essentially just trying to hunt and, you know, subsist on, you know, springbok and nyala and gimbok and these other ungulates just to meet out a livelihood.
Yeah. And I'm sorry, this is so racist, this topic. I'm horrified. I mean, it really is. It's like,
but there is some hope as well.
So good.
I don't wanna like leave it there. I mean, there's a number of black South Africans that are going to parks now, that are getting more involved in tourism, in the tourism industry,
good.
In the protection of wildlife species. So we are seeing some of that actually occur.
However,
we are seeing sort of a whitening of space, if you will, within the interior of South Africa.
So, what do local South Africans think about all of this?
That's a really good question. It depends on who you speak with.
Good point.
Right, and some, you know, white South Africans will say that this needs to happen. We need to like put up fences and create these enclosures because of crime. And it's not about race at all. It's not about class. All it is about, you know, animals, and it's also about, you know, protecting our livelihoods, and that's the thing. There's a lot of trouble with race in South Africa.
Yeah,
right. So it's easy to say, well, that's racist, and just like here in the United States, right?
There's these
gray areas, and it depends on the context and who it's coming from, and so on behind it all. So it's ambiguous at times. But you know, some South Africans believe this is the way to move forward.
Mm-hmm.
If they're really going to meet some of their national and international biodiversity goals. The best way to do that is through the accumulation of land, you know, or private land.
So one of the things about the private land, it's like, all right, let's say you're breeding, I don't know, elephants, okay? And so I've got private land down in the south of South Africa, this beautiful space. The places that, the properties that people are owning in order to do this, are they like usually natural habitat of the animals that they're bringing on?
Yeah, well, I mean, some of the habitat, they're bringing on different species that don't necessarily live in that habitat.
Okay.
As well. So that definitely is happening to some degree in South Africa as well. They're also breeding species that don't necessarily occur in wilder nature, if you will, like, you know, golden wildebeests and, you know, things like that,
yeah.
That don't necessarily occur. But yeah, now they are in these particular enclosures, I guess.
So, like, basically, you're getting, like, designer animals to hunt. It's kind of like, you know, how, like, dachshunds now are, you know, long-haired, short-haired, palomino, white, brindle. Like, there's a million different kinds. So now if you can, it's one way to get more money because, oh, my God, I got a normal wildebeest. But look, this one's blonde and sexy. I don't have that on my wall yet. So it's a...
Right, yeah. Suddenly you can have your nice, like, you know, white lion or your one with, like, the black, or your lion with the black mane.
Oh, my God.
Yes, you can... Yeah, exactly. And the thing is, too, you can breed them specifically as well.
Wow.
There's an incredible amount of science that goes into it. You can actually get online. If you make an investment, you can go online and watch your animal grow.
Oh, that's so sick.
They do DNA testing and genetics, and they weigh it, and they give you updates. Oh, yeah, everything, all the minutiae, so you can watch this animal grow to become this perfect specimen that will bring in the greatest amount of money.
That you're going to blow up and make a trash can out of, or, you know, like
that's someone, either yourself or someone else, yeah, we'll go ahead and do later on, yeah, absolutely.
So you've been doing this research for a while. Like, how do you stay sane doing this?
That's a really good question.
I mean, seriously.
I'll let you know when I...
That'll be part two of this interview. We'll be calling you from Bellevue or something.
Yeah, exactly. It's been hard, believe me. There are moments of, you know, what's going on in the world right now and, you know, coupled with my research, it's difficult to move forward. But I do it, you know, I continue to do it because, you know, I love animals and I care about people. So I just hope that in some particular way my research will help animals and, you know, I don't know, at least, you know, engage people in a discussion about, you know, animal justice and, mm-hmm. and where it intersects with, you know, land and social and environmental justice.
It's pretty amazing. Like, you know, when I first tracked you down, I was not expecting so much of this conversation. You know what I mean? Like, in terms of colonialism and things like that really never crossed my mind. I think a lot of times, I mean, my dad used to hunt, and he hunted mm-hmm. until I was about 5, and he came home with I don't know what, and I had a nervous breakdown and yelled at him forever, so he stopped for a very long time. So that was my contribution, which was awesome. But it's so wild to be hearing this in such detail. I mean, it feels like these, like, okay, let's go online and look at Leo because we're going to blow Leo's head off in 2 years. Let's see how sexy he is now. I mean, this is like serial killer stuff. But even serial killers don't kill. So if they recognize someone and they can put a name to someone, they're not going to kill them. So it's even like a deeper depth than that.
I agree. I mean, I think it's kind of perverse to that we refer or they refer to these animals as game, right? Because the game would imply that, you know, there are two equal sides and they know they're involved in a competition, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, animals have no, they don't understand that this is a game. In which only one person, or one animal, rather, loses its life.
Seriously.
Seriously. And I think that's something that hunters need to kind of think about as well. You know, and if they need to really think and look inside themselves, do I really need to keep killing these animals? Or is there an alternative way we can actually create places that just conserve animals? And they argue that a lot of these places where the hunting continues mm-hmm. right now are places that aren't necessarily good for ecotourism. Maybe they're too arid and too dry. They're not as beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
So they say that these landscapes aren't good, or the landscapes aren't good for actually agricultural production, right, because of the dryness as well. So
they're
saying due to climate and geography, it's more conducive to engage in this particular kind of commodification of resources.
Well,
another argument that you encounter quite often. It's like, well, we couldn't make money off ecotourism because people wouldn't come.
Well, Jesus.
Maybe they would.
Well, it's also
and it's more profitable actually in the long run. I mean, if you're able to just do ecotourism without the killing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it provides more jobs as well, far more jobs.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Ugh, Dave, we are so out of time, and I hate this. I could talk to you about this. Really, I could talk to you about this for hours, because it really has... I'm so grateful to have this conversation right now, and I'm so grateful to have learned more about this, because it really seems, you know, from a child's mind, which I really have when it comes to this, it's like trophy hunting bad. And I still, you know, even mm-hmm. after speaking to you, I'm still there completely. But, like, to hear the reasons of why it happens and why it's accepted has really broadened my horizons on it and has made me understand how complicated of an issue this is, that it's not just like rich kid going down, bang, bang, dead animal, bring it home, pretty. Right. You know, there's so much more to that. And I really want to thank you also for having the guts to do this. I can't imagine that this is, you know, this takes bravery and this takes a lot of guts to see what's actually really happening. So I want to say thank you for that very, very much.
Well, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to talk about my research and what I'm passionate about. Thank you very much.
Oh, my God, my pleasure. So where can we send people if they want to know more about this topic? Is there a simple website, or should I use the one that you gave me earlier? We can put it on our webpage.
Yeah, the one that I gave you, I think that would be pretty good.
Okay.
International Fund for Animal Welfare. I can send you some additional things as well.
Cool.
I can't think of anything offhand right now that's, but yeah.
Well, some of those addresses were like major long. So for anybody that's interested, I'll put it on the Animal Instinct page for Heritage Radio. If it's not up there tonight, it's going to be in the comments, and I'll put it on the Facebook page as well. So if anybody wants to continue their research, we'll give you some information or some links so you can do that. So, Dave, thank you so much. Like I said, I really appreciate this. I've been wanting to do this interview for years, and you've really answered a lot of questions for me. And keep going, babe. I really, really appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. I'm going to need that.
if it starts getting slower, you start getting crazy, call me, and I'll give you a big, like, you can do it, man! You know, I'll be your cheerleader for you.
I might need that. Thank you.
Thank you. And for all of the rest of y'all, are you a Heritage Radio Network member yet? Membership not only supports the production and broadcast of this show, but also comes with some perks. All current members are invited to our new monthly happy hour series, Books and Brews. Join us on April 12th at Three's Outpost at Franklin and Kent in Greenpoint, Brooklyn, with host of Eat Your Words, Kathy Airway, and her new book, The Food of Taiwan. Meet other members, snag the signed copy of The Food of Taiwan, and enjoy some beer from HRN business member Threes. Donate at heritageradionetwork.org/donate to get your exclusive invite today. And these are super fun, so I recommend them if you're local. For everybody else, thank you again so much for listening. I really, really appreciate it. I'm really grateful to be able to get topics like this out to you. So if you donate, you can keep me here. I can keep talking about groovy stuff. I will be back next week. I'm not positive if I have a new interview or not, but I will be here so you can listen to me chat. Until then, thank you again and take care.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.